Hallo zusammen und willkommen bei Audioarchiv, dem Kanal für historische Interviews mit SchriftstellerInnen, PhilosophInnen, AktivistInnen und Intellektuellen aus aller Welt.
Hallo. Täglich werden in den USA und Europa neue Maßnahmen gegen MigrantInnen und Flüchtlinge beschlossen. Parteien verschärfen Gesetze unter dem Applaus Rechtsradikaler. Diese inzwischen europaweit sehr gut vernetzt, feiern trotzdem oder gerade deshalb überall Wahlerfolge. Migration, so sagen die PolitikerInnen, sei zwar begründet. Wer würde dem widersprechen? Man muss sich nur den Energieverbrauch pro Kopf in der Welt anschauen. Kann aber durchaus bekämpft werden. Als sei die Flucht von Menschen eine Art Verwirrung der MigrantInnen, die durch härtere Einwanderungsgesetze geheilt werden könnte. Und dann wäre alles gut. Die MigrantInnen blieben glücklich in ihren Herkunftsländern, also ihrer Heimat. Der rechtsradikale Spuk verschwände und die PopulistInnen im Internet, in TikTok, Facebook und wo auch immer würden ihre Dummheit erkennen und Abbitte leisten. Kein Flüchtling müsste mehr im Mittelmeer ertrinken und unsere eigenen rassistischen Nachbarn zu Hause würden zu SozialarbeiterInnen werden. Asi Vanandan folgt einer anderen Argumentation. Sie geht vereinfacht so. Eure Wirtschaftsweise, also die profitmaximierte Globalisierung, bestimmt unsere Politik, also die der Länder der Dritten Welt, die uns, also die Menschen der Dritten Welt, zu Flüchtlingen bei euch macht, also in der Ersten Welt. Das heißt also, dass wer sein Land verlässt, um woanders hinzugehen in unserer Gegenwart, gar keine andere Wahl hat. Die digitale Globalisierung zwingt ihn, jedes Risiko auf sich zu nehmen. Vergewaltigung, Ertrinken, Gefängnis. Denn die globalen Konzerne machen die Heimat der Migrantin mithilfe der lokalen Bourgeoisie lebensunwert. Dieses Primat der Umverteilung und Profitmaximierung währt seit über 30 Jahren und bestimmt die Regeln der internationalen Politik. Dabei erzeugt diese Weltunordnung, sagt A. Sivanandan, nicht nur eine erste Welt in der dritten, also eine Art globalisierte Internationale der Bourgeoisie, sondern auch eine dritte Welt in der ersten. Zu dieser dritten Welt in der ersten gehören wiederum MigrantInnen, aber auch People of Color, alleinstehende Frauen, TagelöhnerInnen, Kinder und verarmte RentnerInnen. Globalisierung macht uns alle zu Sklaven. Globalization makes slaves of us all, sagt Ambalava Sivanandan. Viel Spaß.
Die erste Einwanderungswelle, gefördert durch den britischen Staat, erfordert durch wirtschaftliche Entwicklung, durch den Kapitalismus aus den Kolonien, hat die Menschen hier hingebracht. Die wurden verwaltet und organisiert. Heute spricht man von einer zweiten neokolonialen Welle, die sich aber anders äußert. Wiederholen sich diese Dinge oder ist die Globalisierung etwas anderes? The first coming of people to Britain after the war was in colonial time. They came from colonized countries to Britain. After that period, there was the independence of many of these countries. Now, people in times of globalization, they are speaking about a second coming colonialism. And again, lots of people coming to Western countries. First question, was there a difference in this independent times? Second question, can one compare the first colonization with the second one after the fall of the Soviet Union?
Common denominator is not the question of independence, but the question of the changes, the sea change in the mode of production, the sea change in society, from an industrial society to an information society. From a society where the labor was needed to a society where labor was not so much needed as before because of computers, electronic revolution, the information revolution, and so on and so forth. So I don't want to connect it to the question of India, because now India got independence in 1948, and so the Indian laborers who came here were still British citizens. They had two citizenships. I came as a Sri Lankan, as a Ceylonese, But I had both Ceylon citizenship and British citizenship. Other countries of Africa, Ghana became independent very early on. Other countries of Africa and the Caribbean might have got independence later. But the independence by itself did not bother the migration patterns here. What conditioned the migration patterns were the laying off of labor by the European countries once the post-war reconstruction was over. And in Britain, because of the European Union, the EEC, as well, because as Britain enters the EEC, then it begins to get laborers from Europe, and did so that it let go of black labor from the colonies and closed the door on it with the Immigration Acts and opened the door to European immigration in terms of the skills, etc., that they needed. Because that way, they didn't have a problem about race. Because by this time, in the 60s, there were a number of rebellions taking place in the inner cities of this country. You see, the advantage we had over, say, Germany, was that we came as citizens. So we demanded our rights to vote. We demanded our rights to fight. We demanded our rights. We had that. Whereas the Turks in Germany didn't have citizenship. So they had a double bind. So when I say that black was a political color in Britain and is unique, it is also, it's not our virtue that black became, and it's partly because we were citizens and partly because we were very strong as communities and we began to build our own newspapers, our schools, Sunday schools, Saturday schools, summer schools, in the churches, in the gurdwaras, in the temples. So there's a whole infrastructure that we built up.
Ist das auch ein Teil der Auswirkung des 19. Jahrhunderts, 1851, 53, der sogenannte British Language Act, der also alle Verwaltungen in den Kolonien damals zwang, dass die englische Sprache zur Verwaltungssprache wurde? Was it that easy, or easy in a way, was it possible to organize yourself in this society here, also because of the so-called British Language Act in the 19th century,
because
all of you spoke minimum two languages.
Yes, of course. There were a lot of people from the villages in Pakistan and India, especially the women, who may not have been able to speak English, but they learned it fast enough. And yes, having a common language, unlike in Germany and places, helped a great deal for us to help us to organize. And also a common tradition, maybe, because English, British colonialism, because there was a cultural imperialism. We almost went to the same colleges and same schools and all learned Shakespeare. So there's a whole background from which we came, which allowed us to meet with each other and fight for each other. So yes, that was a very important factor. Now, to come back to your question. So the migration pattern now begins to, the migration closes up from the new Commonwealth. Migration opens up to Europe, and particularly Eastern Europe, where labor is cheaper, etc. Then what happens is that all the struggles that, and you know, in 1981, the big riots in the country, in 1981-85, were because of police racism and the criminalization of the black community and the criminalization of the Asian peoples on the factory, the non-unionization of Asian workers on the factory floor. And because of all this, there were riots took place all over the country. Afro-Caribbeans, Asian kids, everywhere. We remember this, the big fights against the police. They burned cars, they brought, you heard about the riots in Brixton. And then they set up this great big commission under Lawrence Carman to see what should be done. And the government came out with this great proposal. Lawrence Carman came out with a great proposal that what Afro-Caribbean nations were suffering from was racial disadvantage, as though it was some disease that we were prone to, some genetic disease. And for that racial disadvantage, he said, we must put more money into the ghettos, that's all right, and give them an English education, that's all right, and help them with their culture. My point, when I was interviewed on television, I said, was giving me all these things is like breaking my legs and giving me crutches. My answer to you is, don't break my legs. The problem is not the problem of my culture. The problem is that in your culture, there's a lot of racism which prevents me from being an equal citizen with you. To know about my culture is not to know about the racism of yours. So you study the racism of your culture, then you can come to my culture objectively.
Gleich geht's weiter mit dem Interview. Zuvor noch der kurze Hinweis. Liked uns, wenn es euch gefällt.
So, Carmen's recommendations ethnicized the race problem. So suddenly there was money being put into various groups: Pakistanis, Indians, Muslims, Hindus, lesbians, gays, this, that, the whole world. So everybody, so that unity that we had as a black community began to fragment, began to break up. And everybody in the black community was up for grabs, right? We also were up for grabs, and that's how we got this building. We played the same card, you see. We said we can't fight with bare hands. We must get power from the system to fight the system. In the process, five, six of us might become corrupt. But if three or four will stay back, then we got a way of getting on.
Wie hat sich das nach dem Zusammenbruch der Sowjetunion, nach der Einführung einer offiziellen Politik, die als Neoliberalismus bezeichnet wird, als Globalisierung bezeichnet wird, wie hat sich die Migration nach Großbritannien dadurch verändert und wie haben sich die Gruppen, die in Großbritannien schon lebten, dadurch verändert?
So now get a pattern where labor begins to fall off. Now, underlying this pattern is also the economic factor, which is that society was undergoing a sea change where capital was comparatively becoming emancipated from labor. Because of the computer revolution, because of the electronics revolution, because of the technological revolution of the 70s and 80s and so on, with the beginning of the technological revolution, capital didn't need to import labor. Capital can go to labor. Capital can go to places where labor is cheapest, where it is plentiful, in Southeast Asia, in Latin America, in Africa, and it could go from one labor pool to another, because the factory could be held in your hand. A factory was a computer factory, so there was CAD and CAM, computer-aided design, computer-aided machinery. You didn't need big shipyards, you didn't need big factories, you didn't need thousands of work laborers on one factory floor in Dagenham to build your Ford car. Your building of your car was stretched across the continents. Somebody made fan belts, somebody made wheels, other people made differentials. And you assembled them, perhaps in Malaysia, and sold them back to Britain. So capital, whereas the socialists are waiting to emancipate labor from capital, but the technological revolution, of course I'm talking in broad terms, but the technological revolution did was to emancipate capital from labor. Comparatively speaking. So now capital could take up its factory and walk to any part of the world, to any labor pool. But it must be a labor pool which could not be controlled by the government. So capital needed to have, capital we are now talking about, multinational corporations come into being. Multinational corporations, to be able to do this, to have the type of labor it wanted, need a political system in these countries which could repress labor, which could dole out labor in the way that capital wanted it. So for instance, in Sri Lanka, they set up free trade zones. A free trade zone was a colony within a colony. In that free trade zone, there were no trade union rights. There were no working hours. You could exploit. In fact, the Prime Minister of my country at that time, J.R. Jayawardena, said, open these free trade zones and said, let the robber barons come. And if Sri Lanka had something like 85% literacy rate, 80% turnout at elections, and so on. And very powerful trade union movement. You probably know that the biggest Trotskyite party in the world at the time was in Sri Lanka, long before Allende came into power in Chile as a Trotskyite, as a socialist. So we had all that going for us. And suddenly, with the coming of the multinational corporations into our countries, the labor force began to be cordoned off from this. So that was one thing that happened. The next thing that happened was that these countries, the poor countries, these poor countries are now given aid. We went through a period after we became independent where we tried to have an independent economy. We had our own import substitution programs, our own tire factories and textile factories. We tried to develop something. But when the multinational corporations came in, our textile factories closed down. Our tire factories closed down. They took over the thing. And they had very cheap labor. And if it was not working, the electronics industry was not good in Malaysia, they moved to Singapore. If they're not good in Singapore, they moved to Sri Lanka. If they're not good there, they went to Latin America, and so on. So, or in Mexico. So they began to have multinational corporations began to have what required a political system in these countries which assured them that the labor would be captive and cheap. Now, how would this political system remain in that position if the workforce and if the people want to overthrow it? And there were elections, and we want to overthrow in Sri Lanka, for instance, the Jayawardena government. But the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, all send funds into the country in order to keep these governments in power, right? And subsequently, you get the next stage of neocolonial enterprise through multinational corporations is when the World Bank and the IMF say, this is, you've got to pay back your debts, so we become debt-strapped. Or they began bringing structural adjustment programs. Now, Sri Lanka had a free health service and a free education service when we got independence. I was brought up on free education. My father was very poor. I came from a very, very poor family, from the north of Ceylon, where nothing grows except children. And all we had was education. And we had all these facilities there. But education was free, health was free. When the structural adjustment programs came in, when the IMF began to give us money, and World Bank, they said, no more free education, no more free health service. So the whole infrastructure of health and education became damaged. And we became more dependent. And we couldn't fight the government in power without some sort of armed struggle. And that armed struggle sometimes broke up into ethnic wars between each other. And so, the coming of globalization and multinational corporations brought in a new imperialism, which destroyed our countries, brought in regimes that were dictatorial. There was democracy in the sense of voting, but they were authoritarian governments. What is the use of giving me a vote if you can bribe me to vote for the other side? And so on. And there was a lot of corruption. And that made for refugees. If I took up arms against my government, I was imprisoned. The only way I could get out of the prison was to get out of the country. And therefore, there were a whole lot of political refugees that were coming out of third world countries. That is the period we are talking about. What happened in the globalization is, in summary, if I can put it to you like this, if I can say that you are America and you are the Western powers, I would say to you that it is your economics that creates our politics that makes us refugees in your country.
Sie sprechen jetzt von den Flüchtlingen, die hauptsächlich aus politischen Gründen kommen. Ich möchte noch einmal darüber sprechen, dass sich in den letzten 10, 15 Jahren auch die Beweggründe für die Migration verändert haben in den sogenannten Dritte Weltländern. Können Sie da sagen, was da die Ursachen sind und welche Strategien da wirksam wurden dafür, dass viele Leute das Land verlassen haben? You were talking about political refugees coming from third world countries, but I would like also to talk about people who are coming because of economic reasons. They have the last 10, 15 years. Maybe they want to have a better life. They have better communication. They see how people live in the West. Maybe they are so poor that they cannot afford to live in their country. They have to send some of their families to Western countries. Can you explain this connection between migration and economics in the last 10, 15 years?
Yeah, there is no distinction. I make no distinction between an economic refugee and a political refugee. Because our economics, the economics in our third world countries have been complete. I'll come to the Eastern Europe in a minute, the so-called second world. I use the third world as still a category, as a relationship of power. And therefore, its third world is a useful term. Not because we are third rate, but because in relationships of power, we are worst off. Unlike the second world, which is worse off. So, I don't make a distinction between economic and political refugees because it's the politics in our country. Oh, come on, Christoph, who wants to leave his country? Sri Lanka is the most beautiful country in the world. You think I would want to leave it? Who wants to leave his country? Who wants to leave his family? And his... Yes, if he can't get a living, if I can't support my children, if my families can't be supported, if I can't get an education without paying for it, if I can't go to the doctor without paying for it, if I can't do any of these things which the structural adjustment programs have inflicted on my country, if my country is so much in debt that what we produce is not enough to pay back the interest, what is that? Is that economics or politics? Or is it political economy? This is a false distinction that the West makes between economics, refugees, and political. I say to you, get out of my country and I'll get out of yours. Take your bloody investments and everything and get out. We'll start from scratch. Nyerere in Tanzania tried that 30, 40 years ago. Ujamaa, he said, people socialism. We won't depend on anybody. We won't get aid. He didn't last. He couldn't last. He had to. There's no autonomous growth anymore. And globalization makes slaves of us all. And it's a handful of people, because what globalization does, and now let me advance from the economic to the, what globalization does is, this is the most prosperous time in human beings' lives. And yet, 2/3 of the world are in poverty. 1/3 of the world is fabulously rich. And then within the Western powers, there's another 2/3, 1/3 society, where the majority, the 2/3, are fairly well off, and the 1/3 are plutocrats. So there is a poverty in the 1/3 which is not visible. There is, in other words, there is a third world within the first world, and they are overrepresented by refugees, asylum seekers, and black people. And in the world as a whole, the third world is 2/3. And the one, I'm being schematic again, and the 1/3 have all the riches and all the power. Now, that is globalization for you. And what globalization has done, because there is no opposition now, this is the new world disorder. Globalization creates a monolithic economic system. Right? It's capitalism, capitalism, capitalism. And then nation states under this situation fall in thrall to multinational corporations. Nation states are not bothered about the poor in their country, about social welfare. That's not their primary concern. Their primary concern is the businessmen and how to represent them. And businessmen are not national anymore, they're international. So the world is not divided anymore in a sense. It's not a first world, second world, third world anymore. The world is divided horizontally. Because the international bourgeoisie is in Sri Lanka, is in Ghana, is in Trinidad, they belong, the Sri Lankan bourgeoisie doesn't belong to Sri Lanka. It belongs to the international bourgeoisie. It belongs to the multinational corporations. And the states, nation states, even in the West, act on behalf of the multinational corporations and not behalf of its own people in the first instance. So, globalization as a monolithic economic system has those repercussions. Then, after September 11th, they get a monolithic political culture engineered by the United States of America. So that even the language changes. We talk about, every stranger is now a terrorist. If I used to say that black people wear their passports on their faces, now refugees and asylum seekers are terrorists by definition. So, in the time, there's a demonization process going on about asylum seekers and refugees. First they say, oh, these are economic, they're coming to take our goods, they're coming for rubbish. You're putting us in camps, you're putting us in detention centers, you're giving us vouchers. I've come to take your jobs, put in another prison. I was in prison at home, now you put me in another prison. And now you're going to segregate my children. Right, apartheid. Right, children should be the measure of our humanity. If you begin to say, yes, your children are my children, we are finished. So there's a political culture which talks about, which says that all liberation groups in this country are terrorists until they are proved innocent. Now it's the same way I say when the black nationalists said, we say all white people are racist until they are proved innocent. It's the same way. All refugees, all asylum seekers are illegal and terrorists until they are proved innocent. So we should turn around and say all whites are racist until they are proved innocent. Now what? So you have, on the one hand, globalization creating a monolithic economic system. September 11th creating a political culture all over the world, which is a monolithic too. And those two together begin to threaten civil society in the West as well as everywhere. So under the cover of security, we lose our freedoms. We lose our civil rights. This is very important to note, because when you ask me what I think is going to be the solution to these things, I want to come back to the whole question of civil rights and citizenship.
Wie kann ein solches System eine solche auch in den Köpfen vieler Menschen festsitzende Wahrheit überhaupt verändert werden? How is there a possibility to change not only the system, but first maybe the thinking of the people about the system?
No, I think the thinking and the doing must go together.
This is an old question. Huh?
Yes, because we in the Institute have always said, or race and class, that we want to think in order to do. Because most academic journals think in order to think. That is no good for us. We ought to think in order to do. And then from the doing comes the thinking. There's a symbiosis there. Right. So that again is what capitalism has done to us, you see. Separate our thinking from our doing. So there is a consciousness building within ourselves that we must become aware of. Revolution is not just a changing revolution, not in the big sense of our, but changing society. It's also a process of changing oneself. You can't be a Rolls-Royce revolutionary. Because if you drive a Rolls-Royce, you become bourgeois. So you can't take time off to go to the streets and so on and so forth. So I think being and doing are part of the same continuum.
Danke, dass ihr bei Audioarchiv dabei wart. Folgt uns, dann verpasst ihr keine Folge. Und vergesst nicht den Like-Button. Bis nächste Woche, euer Audioarchiv-Team.